We want to convene the April 26, 2001 House Committee on Agriculture and Forestry. We want to thank all of you for coming here today. We do have a busy agenda, and we're going to get started right away, and we're going to open up a public hearing. It appears, since I don't have a quorum to vote, we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 3975. Ray, would you tell us a little bit about what this bill is about and get a sign-up sheet, Michael? And I'm assuming we will have Messrs. Nelson and Dewey to come forward.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3975 authorizes Agricultural Commodity Commissions to engage in development of intellectual property. It declares an emergency effective on passage. Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you, Ray. Gentlemen, welcome, and for the record, tell us what this is all about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson of the Oregon Tall Fescue Commission and the Oregon Fine Fescue Commission. I'd first like to say, to extend our appreciation to Representative Smith for allowing us to use a priority bill of hers to introduce this subject to the legislature. Currently, most commodity commissions, of the 29 commodity commissions, most of those commissions do not have the statutory authority to hold intellectual properties. And what that means is that in the case of a grass seed commodity commission, for example, if we had contracted with a plant breeder to develop a new variety of tall fescue, then we could not hold or own that variety of tall fescue, and it would be available for somebody else to patent and to then charge the growers royalties for producing it. So in this case, what this bill does is simply grant the authority to commodity commissions to be the holders of those things that they invest farmer money in the development of. Probably the classic example is the Potato Commission contracted with OSU to develop a variety of potatoes, and the Potato Commission, as I'm told, maybe Mr. Dewey might remember this, this is several years ago, did not have the authority to hold that new variety of potatoes, and so it was licensed to a Canadian potato concern. And then our growers, in addition to having had to pay for the development of the variety, had to pay royalties to the Canadian concern to grow the potatoes that they had developed in the first place. So simply what it does, give the extend that authority to commodity commissions. Very simple bill. I know of no opposition to it. I think it's one that can be of value to all of agriculture here in the state.
Thank you, Dave. Mike.
Thank you. Very briefly, for the record, Mike Dewey, Oregon Wheat Growers League, or Oregon, yes, Oregon Wheat Growers League, and the Oregon Potato Commission. I was going to say Wheat Commission, but I do not represent them. The wheat growers and the potato growers have put in millions of dollars into the various commissions over a number of years. As a matter of fact, the Wheat Commission is the first commission in the United States, and obviously the first in Oregon. Its primary goal, as is the Potato Commission, is research and market development. Research is very, very important. And this is really a matter, as I look at it, as a contract. As we give money for an entity to do the research, we should have the opportunity within that contract to talk about patent rights. And it may be that we hold a portion thereof, perhaps not all of it, because there are other monies that come in. But at least we can have those conversations to see if we can reach an agreement where we do have success. Warren Cronstadt on the wheat side was very successful in developing a variety of blends of wheat that were utilized around the world. And it would have been very helpful for us, as we did further research and marketing, to have additional dollars available, particularly in times like this when the price of wheat is at a very low level, as is the price of potatoes. So this would also help tremendously financially during a period when you have low revenues. So we do very much support this piece of legislation.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Gene Wilkinson.
Gene Wilkinson, Oregon Farm Bureau. We also are in support of House Bill 3975, and I just wanted to state that for you today. It seems to me that commissions and commodity councils are grower-funded and grower-controlled. It's a grower's entity for advertising of the commodities that they support and finding new ways of marketing. If that research and those investments result in something that's of value, then it seems to me the commissions or the council should have the opportunity to secure that value by way of intellectual property rights, so that the commodity that is paid for that research and marketing can benefit from the value of that product, that intellectual property. So it seems like a good idea, and the Farm Bureau would support that.
All right. Members, have any questions? We're okay here in terms of any legal issues. Dave?
Mr. Chair, yes. Dave Nelson, for the record. Yes, the bill has been, it was originally written by the Attorney General's office, and they looked at the various commodity commission statutes before writing it. So there are no legal issues that I'm aware of.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
We do have one legal problem.
What's that?
A quorum.
Yeah, we have a legal problem that we're not going to be able to work this bill until we get a few more members here.
I was going to talk a little longer. Looking at the door.
All right. Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else here who'd like to testify on House Bill 3975? John McCulley. No, we don't want to take any time. We'll just come back to it later.
Okay.
Let's just keep rolling. Thank you, John. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, I'm John McCulley. Actually represent three different commodity commissions, the Oregon Processed Vegetable Commission, the Oregon Clover Commission, and the Oregon Orchard Grass Commission. And I apologize for not getting in here in time to sign up on your list, but appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 3975. And I'm just going to take a minute to talk about the impact that this bill, the very positive impact this bill might have on the Oregon Processed Vegetable Commission. This commission was started in 1985, and the sole purpose for this commission is research. And the commission funds various projects in helping growers produce crops at a lower cost per acre. One of the greatest investments they make is in the area of variety development, especially with green beans. Green beans is the foundation for the food processing industry in this state. We have, under the investment that the commission has made of well over $1 million since it was formed just 15 years ago, have developed several varieties of green beans that are now in commercial production on farms in the Willamette Valley. One of the concerns we have is that the contact that has been made in the past year by processing companies in Wisconsin, a major competitive area to ours, the largest green bean production state in the United States, wanting to have access to the varieties that our growers have paid for here. One of the ways that our industry has been able to maintain, in spite of all of the trauma that exists in it right now, is the fact that we have very high quality product and a very high yielding product. If we were to lose those competitive advantages to an already low cost producer, that would further jeopardize the food processing industry in the state. We believe that House Bill 3975 provides an opportunity for the industry to protect those varieties. Our commission is also investing in the development of a variety of broccoli that can be machine harvested. We're getting close. Again, if we don't have control over that variety, other low-cost producers who might be able to get that variety would lower their costs even more and would further diminish the acreage of broccoli that's able to be produced in the Willamette Valley. So we believe that 3975 offers some excellent benefits not only to the commissions themselves, but to the entire food processing industry and agriculture in the state.
Thank you, John. Any questions of John? John, in your testimony, you talk about importing broccoli from Mexico cheaper than what the grower can grow it next to the processing plant here in the valley. Is that accurate?
That's an accurate statement, Mr. Chair. Broccoli is being imported right now. There used to be two processors in the state that contracted for broccoli acreage. There is now only one. The acreage under production in broccoli has dropped by about 50% in the last 2 years. The sad part of that, it is a very high-value commodity. It does take a lot of labor, but it is a very high-return product. And we're just at the threshold of an opportunity, I believe, to be able to regain some competitive advantage in the production of that commodity.
So, John, this bill really is a good bill for the protection of Oregon farmers and our Oregon commodity commissions.
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
It allows us to compete in an ever-changing world market.
That's right, Mr. Chair. When we have to compete, especially in the area of labor, if we can reduce the costs of production that allow us to compete with other areas that may have lower labor costs, it's an advantage to our producers.
Excellent. Okay, thank you, John. Appreciate your comments. Anyone else here would like to testify on House Bill 3975? Hearing none, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3975 and open a work session on House Bill 3975. And we have no amendments, correct, Ray?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3975 to the appropriate Ways and Means Subcommittee with a due pass recommendation.
It has been moved, members. House Bill 3975 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass. Any discussion?
When it comes time for the floor, I'd like to carry this.
There's already been a request, but since it is your priority bill,
I wasn't aware of that, and yeah. I'd be glad to yield. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative King. I appreciate your support. That's very kind.
I can use the points.
Representative Smith, you'll need to coordinate that with Ways and Means when they move that bill out. Thank you. All right. Any further discussion, members? Okay. Is there any objection to passing this bill with a due pass to the Committee on Ways and Means? Hearing none, so ordered. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3975, and we are going to go into a work session on House Bill. No, we're not. No, we're not. Representative Krieger's not here. So we're going to go into a public hearing on House Bill 3834. Ray, do we have amendments to 3834? I believe we do.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have -1 amendments. Also, you should have a hand-engrossed version that incorporates the -1 amendments. And what these amendments do is add agriculture health to the forest health references throughout the measure. They require the study to include agricultural health as well as forest health. They require the Office of Energy to use, to the extent possible, existing information in completing the study. They require the Office of Energy to cooperate with other public and private entities in completing the study, and requires the study to be completed no later than July 1, 2003. The amendments sunsets the substantive portions of the measure on January 2, 2004. It does not sunset the portion on the measure, which Section 3, which authorizes the Biomass Resource Grant Fund. Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ray. Chair would like to call Ken Evans and Michael Graney. Gentlemen. Welcome to you both, and for the record.
For the record, Chair, my name is Ken Evans. Wanted to thank the committee and the chair again for the opportunity to come before you and speak in regards to this bill. The dash ones incorporate some of the discussions we had last time. We've included, as Ray indicated, agricultural issues and health in this program. We incorporated the idea that the study be not necessarily redundant and use available studies that are already being done in a piecemeal basis. And we also incorporated the concept that the study be completed in a timely manner with hopefully an opportunity to come before this body next time. And those were the changes that we gathered from committee last time, and they're reflected in the amendments.
Okay. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Mike Rainey from the Oregon Office of Energy. Just to express our support for the amendments. We think they're good amendments that improve the bill, and we support the bill.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions?
I have a hand engrossed copy of the bill, but I don't actually have the amendment.
There should.
Did we actually get amendments, or did we just get the hand engrossed?
Mr. Chair, you should have had both the amendments.
I just have the hand engrossed, which I thought they
you were. You do, okay. Them. Here's an amendment if you want to shoot some copies of that. We'll thank you. Representative Nolan, for bringing that to attention. We'll shoot some amendments. I think we have some coming, actually. Okay.
Well, thank you.
Okay, so gentlemen, we are just putting a time frame on the bill. We're adding language that says we're going to utilize what's out there in terms of databases and current research, and basically bring all of that together. We've got a sunset on it, and we've made a couple other small changes in terms of adding agricultural issues in there too. So that sounds about like it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
On this one? Okay. All right. Any questions? Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. We're going to close. Anyone else here would like to testify on House Bill 3834? Hearing none, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3834 and open a work session on House Bill 3834. Chair to entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
So moved.
Members, it has been moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments into the House Bill 3834. Discussion? Any objection? So order. Chair would entertain a motion to move the bill.
So moved.
Members, it's been moved House Bill 3834 with due pass recommendation as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none? So ordered. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 3834. Okay. Yes. Okay. I think we're going to hear House Bill 3961 next. This is Ray. You're going to tell us a little bit about this bill, if you would, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3961 establishes a wine privilege tax credit for manufacturer of wine for the cost of a qualified marketing activity that promotes Oregon and Oregon products. It defines terms and it specifies an effective date. Mr. Chair.
Okay. The chair is looking for Jim. Jim, you're here. Jim. And there's another gentleman also signed up. And I apologize. I cannot read your writing. Forgive me. Oh, it's Gary's writing. Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. Well, please come forward, sir. Welcome to you both. And for the record, please state your name. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruno. I'm the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards, and I'm also chair of the Oregon Wine Growers Association Legislative Committee.
Welcome. Thank you. And what's this bill all about? What are we doing here?
Well, what this bill does is it allows...
Jim, could you pull that microphone close? It's a tough one. Thanks.
It allows us to address a real problem we're facing in the Oregon wine industry. For example, on the attachments that I've provided you to the one-page letter, you can see that Oregon wine sales have grown ever since our industry began, up until 1999, when Oregon wine sales actually fell. This occurred in all of our markets. We believe the reason why this is, and actually our sales fell in market conditions that are actually quite favorable to our industry. You know, where we have double-digit growth rates in the premium and super premium category. We believe the reason why we're having difficulty is because our competitors from California and Washington, and even foreign competitors like from Australia and Chile, are far more aggressive in their marketing efforts. And because the Oregon wine industry is small, and actually we rank second in the nation among states in terms of numbers of producers, we rank fourth in overall production. But because our industry is made up of such small players, we do not have the economies of scale to afford the marketing efforts that our competitors can. And so we have been working for ways to add additional resources to our industry's marketing efforts. And this is an approach that we thought would find acceptance among the legislators. What this bill does is it would allow wineries who are taxpaying wineries, gallonage taxpayers, we pay 65 cents a gallon for our sales here in Oregon. It would allow us to take up to 25% of that gallonage tax as a credit against approved marketing expenses that have been approved by the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, which is a part of the Department of Agriculture. For wineries that pay the tax below the 40,000 gallon exemption, it would allow those wineries to take a dollar per dollar credit. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission estimates that this could cost about $170,000 a year. In other words, that would be the effect of the credit if everyone fully participated to the maximum. And so that's the extent of the impact based upon the design of this bill. But we believe that as we're able to apply more marketing effort to the sale of Oregon wine, we will actually generate more tax revenue as sales grow, partially offsetting, at a minimum, the effect that the credit will have. And that's essentially the effect of the bill.
Sir.
Yes, my name is Jess Lyon. I'm the legal counsel for the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I'm actually here to answer any questions you might have about the workability of the bill. We can hold that now, whatever your preference.
The reason why I asked, Jess represents our industry from Davis-Wright Tremaine, and we had heard that there was concerns raised by Paul Romaine about its constitutionality. And so our attorney is here to answer those questions.
Okay, well, in that regard, Paul, since you're here, would you join them at the dais, if you would, and let's talk about that issue and get into the meat of this thing.
I would love to, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Paul. It's good to see you here. I've not had the pleasure of you before my committee to beat up on yet this session, so just joking, Paul.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I look forward to the abuse you will heap upon me. Our problem is not with the goal of the bill. Our problem is with the method. The problem is that under the Bacchus case, it's Bacchus Imports versus Diaz. It's located at 468 U.S. 263, 1984. That case basically, under that case, you cannot, by special tax policy, favor the in-state wine. In-state, pretty much anything, but basically that dealt with wine. It dealt with a Hawaii wine, by the way, of all things. What you can do is do an appropriation to benefit. But for example, you can't set different tax rates for a in-state wine versus not a state wine. Let me kind of back up a little bit. When the original exemption was put in for Oregon wineries in the 70s, I believe, mid-70s or so. No, that was when it was changed. It was actually put in, I believe, around the mid-70s. And what happened was the law was specifically said that Oregon wines are exempt. First, I believe it was, I don't know if it was the exact same gallonage that it is today. That was changed, and maybe it was 81 when it came in, and then it was changed later after the Bacchus case came out to say any domestic winery, the current exemption, any domestic winery that produces 100,000 gallons or less is exempt from tax in Oregon for the first 40,000 gallons it sells within the state of Oregon. So if you produce less than 100,000, you're exempt from the first 40,000 that you sell. So if you go over 100,000 gallons in production, then you have to pay the tax on all the wine. And it, again, applies to all domestic wineries, and that was to get around the Bacchus case. Basically, the tax credit has the same problem. And I just, in fact, I went upstairs to call a friend of mine, Professor Steve Diamond from the University of Miami. Steve teaches the only alcoholic beverage control class in the country, University of Miami Law School. And he confirmed to me, basically, you can't, in effect, do the benefits by tax policy. You can do by appropriation. And we would encourage the appropriation, and we have no problem with that. We think promotion of Oregon products is a good thing. That may be something you wish to do. But I strongly suggest, before you go any further with this bill, if you are going to do it as a tax credit, that you do it, you get an attorney general or at least a legislative council opinion on whether or not you have problems with the Bacchus. Thank you.
Jesse, your thoughts were in relation to Paul's comments there.
Sure. I had the pleasure of reading the case last night, as a matter of fact. Well, I'd just like to explain some of the nuances in this bill that are there purposely to make sure that we don't have any discriminatory tax situation that might violate the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And there's two cases that are illustrated. One is the Bacchus case, and that was a situation where Hawaii imposed, I believe, a 20% excise tax on all wholesale sales of liquor within the state, and then later determined to grant an exemption to fruit wines that were manufactured in Hawaii. And clearly, because that law was discriminatory in both its purpose and its effect, it resulted in a direct price subsidy for those Hawaiian fruit winemakers. The court deemed that unconstitutional. There's a later case in 94 in the dairy industry in Massachusetts, which is called Westland Creamery. And in that case, there's a milk pricing order, which, again, imposed an assessment on all milk sold within the state of Massachusetts at retail. That entire assessment then was held in segregated funds and then distributed back only to Massachusetts dairy farmers based on their proportionate contribution to milk produced within the state. So again, in that situation, both in-state and out-of-state wineries were taxed, and then the entire amount of that assessment was turned back to only in-state interest.
And
that was a narrowly decided case, and it was deemed unconstitutional. But if you look at those two cases together and track some other case on the issue, there's basically four alternative ways that a state tax mechanism might violate the Commerce Clause. And the first is if it conditions some tax payment based solely on the locale of the taxpayer or the origin of the products that are actually being taxed. And on that element, this bill is fine because all wine sold in Oregon remains subject to the exact same privilege tax assessment on the exact same terms, regardless of where it was made. The second concern is whether there's a benefit solely for a local industry from revenues that are set apart and not available to the otherwise available to the general funds. Here, these tax assessments are the portion of Oregon wine taxes that are allocated to general funds. It doesn't rely on any segregated funds, and in fact, they're not available only to Oregon wineries. In fact, they're available to any domestic winery that pays these tax that is promoting wine made from the sale of Oregon grapes. So I know there are instances where we have California wineries that are perhaps purchasing grapes or bulk wine, particularly some of the Oregon Pinot Gris that are very well recognized, marketing that under their label but with an Oregon appellation. And we believe that those activities will also be eligible for this application. Third, there's no direct entitlement here to in-state taxpayers. Rather, it's not a direct subsidy. It's looking at particular activities that are in the interest of the state to promote. There's no direct price subsidy here, which has been a concern in the other cases. And then fourth, possible way that could violate the Commerce Clause is if there were taxes on out-of-state goods that were somehow subsidizing local producers. And a key element of this bill is that it's capped actually on the amount that each individual taxpayer applying for it would pay, and therefore mathematically it would be possible that impossible rather that any taxes paid by out-of-state wineries would somehow be subsidizing any efforts by in-state wineries. So we've run through all four of those elements. We're confident the bill could move forward on that basis without concern, and we're certainly happy to provide our comments in writing to anybody else who desires them.
Microphone, Jim.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to add that in the rush for LC to produce this bill, they didn't quite get it right, and so there's a number of technical amendments that we need to make to this bill. One of them actually speaks to the issue that Mr. Romaine raised, and actually it's the same issue that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission raised. They said that the bill needs to be, the language needs to be changed so that this would promote wine made from grapes grown in Oregon and by producers that pay the tax. So there's a couple other changes that need to be made in this bill as well that are, but my testimony does speak generally to the bill's intent.
So you're saying that you expect amendments then? Okay, Paul, your thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I haven't had a chance to read Jess's memo, but I have been doing liquor law for a long time, too long. And I do, again, I want to emphasize, we're not trying to stop them from getting money to promote Oregon wines. We actually think that's a good thing. That helps everybody. But we do, I still believe the method, and I would, it, as long as you're waiting for some other amendments to the bill, my suggestion to you is just ask Legislative Council. Again, there is a way you know, to get an appropriation. With the two cases that were mentioned, the Westland Creamery and the Bacchus Import case, basically what they said is, look, you can't collect taxes and dish the taxes back out. You can't do it. But what you can do is do a separate appropriation that comes in effect from general funds or whatever. It's a sleight of hand, and it's basically, and sometimes you have to play the sleight of hand game. I would strongly suggest that while you're waiting for the amendments, just have Legislative Council give you a quickie opinion on the effect of Bacchus and Westland Creamery on this particular method of doing it. And we don't have anything invested in this at all. I don't care, you know, if they want the same amount of money through an appropriation, great, wonderful. What we do care about sometimes is the disparate treatment, tax treatment, with all the wines out there. But it is very legitimate for the Oregon Legislature to try and promote Oregon products. And we produce some of the best product in the world here. We have no problem with it, just we would really like to make sure it's constitutional.
Question for all of you. How does this work into the NAFTA-GATT agreements and now the potential FTAA in terms of violations of those rules that are set up?
Mr. Chair, Paul Romaine, interesting you should ask. Basically, most of the industry, especially in alcoholic beverages, has taken its head and buried it in the sand because those are very real issues. Whether the allegations, for those of you who are not familiar with it, are that the special treatment afforded to the in-state wine or beer, for example, or domestic, as far as like beer has a domestic tax break. I don't know if wine does. Does wine have a domestic tax break too, federally? Or no? Okay. But those things are what's called into question, that we can't be taxing under NAFTA or under any of the free trade agreements or the general tariffs our wines differently than we tax the French or the Canadian or anybody else who's producing the wine or beer. They're very real issues. Our response generally to them is to put our head in the sand and ignore them, hoping that nobody will bring a case, and that's probably what we should do in this situation. But they are very real issues, but I don't suggest you go there because you may be faced with a situation where you have to relook the benefits the Oregon wineries currently do get, or domestic wineries get. It's not just Oregon, it's all the domestic wineries. My suggestion is you withdraw that question.
Question, Mr. Chair, if you don't have to follow up.
Okay, Representative Smith.
Mr. Romaine, in the people who you represent and the beer and wine distributors, you distributed Oregon wine as equally as out-of-state wine?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we distribute anything we can get our hands on.
Okay.
Oregon, Washington, French.
So are you saying you've come to the table without a financial interest in your argument, as the basis for your argument?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have a financial interest, and we'd like to see wine promoted,
mm-hmm.
and that's fine. And like I said earlier, we would like to see, we don't care about you doing an appropriation to promote Oregon wines. That's fine.
I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah,
we
like them there.
Because we would like to see our Oregon wineries, which I consider farmers, you know, to promote their products
yeah.
first, and you're not against that at all.
In return for the couple of cases of 98 Pinot, I would too.
Well, me too. Thank you.
Now, you may want to withdraw that comment, Representative. Or excuse me.
No, don't
go there. All right, please, Jim, if you would respond to the original question about competition. You know, we're facing, when we're looking at the FTAA, possibly. I mean, the underlying agreement has been signed. Now they're going to be talking about details. What about foreign wines coming into this country that might be subsidized by those governments and your ability to compete?
Mr. Chair, this is, and you know this whole subject very well, and it not only affects the industries that you're familiar with, but it does ours. You would be amazed at the tax treatment that we receive when we go to Australia to sell our wines. You would be stunned if you knew what the tax burden was that we face when we try and sell our wines in France, even in England, where the common market and Australia is included in its preferential tax treatment. Australia wines sell for significantly lower price points because of the tax treatment we receive in the United Kingdom. I could go on and on about this subject.
So there's most definitely an inequity there, and you would all agree with that.
Okay.
So what we're trying to accomplish here in this legislation is some methodology of helping Oregon wines be promoted out there to find some market share, and that's really where we're trying to go. And Paul, your point is just do it in a legal manner that's not run doesn't run afoul of any constitutional issues, and you're fine with it if there's any kind of a direct appropriation.
Yes.
Okay. But you all are saying you need some amendments to get where you want to go here.
Yes.
Okay.
And we agree that the constitutional question should be laid to rest. We don't want a piece of legislation that will later not serve our interests. I do appreciate this committee's help, and the reason why is that there are 10,500 acres of vines now planted in Oregon, but 2,400 of those acres are yet producing, which means our growers, which are mostly small, are facing dramatically declining prices and uneconomic farming conditions in the future if we do not grow our market.
Representative Doyle and then Representative Ackerman.
You folks are privy to the legislative fiscal analysis we just received. Maybe we might be able to get a copy over to them. One of the things that seems rather significant, Jim, is that where you're saying it's a $170,000 cost, legislative fiscal came back and said, no, it's $10 million in cost. And I'd be surprised if we even have collected $10 million in wine tax from anybody in the world compared to just our Oregon wineries.
Mr. Chair, if I can comment, there are right now 9 wineries in Oregon that are above the exemption level that pay tax on 411,000 gallons at 65 cents. I have been in communication with a fellow named Alex Lennox, who is the research analyst for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And I went over the proposed amendments that we're planning to put to the bill, which would narrow the definition of the bill. And he said he estimated, based upon those numbers, and he thinks it'll be around $170,000 a year if everyone fully participates. I remember that most likely will not happen because, you know, some wineries may not get qualified marketing plans approved through the, you know, and get full and get 100% participation. The way the bill originally was worded, and this was just in, I think, legislative counsel's haste, is that it basically made it possible, under the strict reading of this language, for a very large producer like Gallo, for example, to promote Oregon filberts in the sale of their wine and qualify under the bill. So that's the problem, and I think what we need to do is get the bill amendments prepared, get the bill narrowed, and then let people make their estimates.
Could I, Mr.
Yes,
Chair,
please, Paul, go ahead.
Responding, I just saw this analysis, and I guess where I come from, we have this old saying, it's called from your mouth to God's ear. We wish that there was that much. You know, we don't sell this much.
Right.
And we would really like to be able to say that you'd have a reduction of $9 million in tax rate. We would love to come in here and say you would have that kind of reduction.
My thought is, if you look at the second to the last paragraph, I think it looks to 400,000 gallons of wine as opposed to 40,000. That might be the difference.
It could be an error in mathematics here,
potentially. Who knows?
Somebody blew the decimal point somewhere.
Interesting. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just to the proponents of the bill, I have a problem with granting a tax credit against an expense rather than a tax credit against profit or a tax credit against a tax that would be payable. Do you know of any other examples where tax credits are so generously given?
This is Jeff Lyon. One that comes to mind is a number of the tax credits that may be available, and we'll probably hear more available for, say, energy conservation practices that are implemented. They're not tied. Those are not even tied necessarily to activity that would further increase revenues that are taxable. Here, what we're looking at is a credit granted only with respect to activities that we hope to encourage, which is these certain qualified marketing activities. And again, that's capped. There could be no greater credit than the amount of tax that was actually paid with respect to only these privileged taxes.
Okay, another question.
Certainly.
Is this tax credit limited to the gallonage that would be sold out of state, or the total amount of the gallonage of the winery, whether it was sold in state or out of state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the tax that we pay is on wine sold in Oregon, so it applies to the wine that we sell in Oregon.
Okay.
The tax credit. The gallonage tax is applied against us as producers, regardless of our income, mm-hmm. as you know, and so that's why we thought it was logical to apply the marketing expense against that tax.
Okay. And I assume, although I don't think the definition of qualified marketing activity is designed to promote Oregon products outside of Oregon. A qualified marketing activity just says promotes Oregon or Oregon products. Is you're in contention that your marketing activity must be related to the promotion of Oregon products outside the state rather than inside the state in order to qualify for the credit?
First of all, we do have amendments prepared to deal with that particular language, but our intention was to basically go to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board as an industry, make proposals there for wine marketing plans, and then following their procedures and criteria, get those plans qualified, which would promote the sale of Oregon wine both in the state and out of the state. An example of that, for example, would be, let's say, putting a special effort on Gourmet Magazine or Sunset Magazine, which readers both reside in Oregon and out of Oregon. That kind of news, that kind of coverage in those magazines would greatly promote the sale of our products and would have a beneficial effect in both.
Okay, I have one more question, Mr. Chair.
Sure, please.
I haven't had a chance to pursue all the information since it was just given to us, but one of your charts in justification for the credit is based upon the fact that out-of-state wine sales have declined. Suggesting, of course, that we must produce your product more vigorously in the interstate market. But what we don't know is whether the total sales of all Oregon, the gallonage of all Oregon wines has gone up or down over the same time period. Can you relate to that?
Yes. Ms. Vice Chair and Representative Ackerman. On the second page of the my testimony is the actual numbers from the Department of Agricultural Statistics Service, which actually spells it out. And the declines differ based upon which market. For example, in Oregon, sales declined by about 9,500 cases between the 2 years in Oregon, inside the state. For example, Pinot Gris declined by about 2,000 cases in Oregon. In Washington, you can see the numbers there, and then in other states, and I've circled the other states because that's where those huge numbers were experiencing. And so we have seen declines both in and outside of the state. But the issue we're facing is a production issue. We have grapevines in the ground producing fruit, and unless we find markets for them, whether they be in Oregon or outside the state, we've got some real problems ahead of us.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Yes. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Jim, have y'all been to the Economic Development Group?
The Economic
Support here, help?
The Department of Economic and Community Development?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have received some support for them. For example, we're holding a wine show in New York and Washington, D.C., two important East Coast markets this May. And they're helping us financially a little bit for the program. But total effort is a several hundred thousand dollar effort, and they kicked in $15,000 to our effort.
Follow up, Mr. Krieger, Representative Krieger, interim chair?
Maybe.
Whatever. I believe I have more vineyards in my district and county than anybody else, so I want to tell you how proud I am, and I'm not happy to hear this news, because you are my one burgeoning industry since we've had four major industries pull out, and I'm worried sick about you, and hopefully tomorrow we'll be able to do something to cure our problem right in the heart of that wine country to be able to transport the wine, because I know that's one of the problems holding you up. But I'm concerned that, you know, if it's $170,000 or $300,000, is this going in a pot to be used for marketing? If so, then, you know, why isn't the Economic Development Group coming up with this money to support your activities? For goodness sake, we're number one in lack of job growth in this state. So I just like to know why that's not happening. You're not getting the support you need.
Well, it could be, Representative, because the voters have decided to take all the economic development money from lottery sales and spend it on everything else.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's why we want this bill to be referred to Ways and Means. That's where we think the bill should go, and there's a reason and a logic behind it. And our hope is to find the answer to the question that you just raised there. There's a course that is planned for this bill, and there's a logic behind it, and that actually speaks to the logic.
Exactly. I'm aware of that, and I just wanted to help you get on with this, because, it's critical. When our own, you know, state agencies aren't supporting these job growth industries that are critical to the future of this state, something's wrong. And I appreciate everything y'all are doing, and I like Mueller Turgau.
Strike that from the record. All right, Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, you were questioning the accuracy of these figures on the fiscal impact. If you had been to the 60 receptions I've been to, you wouldn't question it, because maybe it's possible for what I saw going on. But I do agree that probably this isn't even close in the realm of reality. And it's like Representative Doyle said down in the second paragraph, they're talking about the first $400,000 gallons. I don't know what a $400,000 gallon is. So there's several errors here.
All right. Thank you, Representative.
I need to ask one last question. It's a statute issue, and it's probably because I've, you know, not read all the way through the 20 volumes yet. I'm just three-fourths of the way, and there's still a month to go. I promised the speaker I'd be through every volume before session's over. But the definition of a winery in the statute is interesting to me.
Have you looked it up? Would you do so before you proceed, please? Because we may need to change that. And I'd be appreciate being, let, if y'all would let me know.
Okay. And members, any further questions? Representative Doyle?
Well, I guess, no further questions. I'm fine. I do have a comment, though.
Please.
If I may. With the amendments that I think we're going to be seeing when we can actually work this bill, we are going to see that it does make sense to move forward on it. It's going to help our Oregon wine growers. And this is something that I've worked with the speaker on so that we can be looking at, I think, a little bigger picture on all of, you know, I guess, promotion of Oregon products. And this is one component of that. So looking forward to getting those amendments and getting it worked.
Excellent.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd also like to say, in line with what Representative Doyle, thank him for bringing this bill forth. And Mr. Speaker, appreciate y'all caring about my people. It has been amazing to me in this session, you know, having such strong business background, and as y'all know, having traveled as much as I have around the world, I have been amazed that in this session we've had so little business development. I mean, when we're desperate. So, you know, we've got to do something. We've heard four other types, or I have only, as long as I've been here, including elk farming and, you know, straw for cogeneration, and OHSU getting bigger. I mean, and that's basically been it as far as substantial growth potential of any business. And we better get serious about it and work on this, or we're all going to be moving to wine country. No, we won't, because they don't have any water or electricity.
All right. Thank you very much. Any additional comments, members? Gentlemen, thank you all very much. We will look forward to seeing you again at a later date.
Thank you.
All right, with that, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3961, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3571. Ray, we have no additional amendments, correct?
No, Mr. Chair, we have the one amendment, the dash one.
Okay. Would you explain to us what the dash ones accomplish?
Well, the dash ones replace the original measure. It removes all swans with the exception of the trumpeter swan from the definition of game bird. Therefore, naming other swan species and predatory animal statutes by default.
Okay. So how does that amend the bill?
Mr. Chair, it completely changes the nature of the original measure. The original measure was to have the State Fish and Wildlife Commission establish an annual swan hunting season. This takes that premise out of House Bill 3571 and replaces it with a change in language of the statute, which changes the swan from one area of the statute to another. One swan. It leaves trumpeter swans, which are protected under the Endangered Species Act, within the protected statute.
Okay, so it leaves the trumpeter swans within the protected statute, and it moves the tundra swan that can be classified as a predatory animal.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is a practical effect of this amendment.
Of the dash one amendment.
Of the dash one amendment.
Okay. Representative Donner, any comments, questions? Okay. Members, questions, comments? All right. The chair would entertain a motion.
I shall move dash one.
Okay. It has been moved, members, into House Bill 3571, the dash one amendment. Representative Ackerman, you look like you want to ask a question.
Yes, I just want to make a
sure.
Several comments. I think that what we're doing here is very clearly making the tundra swan a predatory animal under ORS Chapter 610, which gives almost unlimited authority to persons to take these animals without any discretion or any reason whatsoever. It's my impression that migratory birds, including the tundra swan, are protected under the Migratory Bird Act, which is a federal statute, and we're inviting a conflict between the state authority and I think federal preemption on this particular subject. So for that reason, I think that it's bad policy to pass an act which is flies directly in the face of a federal enactment which appears to preempt these activities. So for those reasons, I'm against the bill. I haven't been persuaded by anything I've heard here that of the particular damage that the Tundra Swans are causing. I think if they are, it would be more creative, as we've seen in other situations, for people affected in these districts, farmers affected in these districts, form some sort of an assessment group to provide for compensation for losses or seek some sort of reimbursement from the state. I think that would be more productive than just eradicating a species of animal. Lastly, Mr. Chair, I have a question with the relating clause in that it originally the bill relates to swan hunting and amends statutes which are not relevant at this time, 496 rather than 610. I may be hindered on that, but I don't seem to have the dash one amendments, but unless that was clarified, I think we have a problem with the relating clause, and we may have a legal problem as well as I think is a substantial factual and policy problem in dealing with this bill.
Thank you, Representative Ray. I think Representative Ackerman brings up an important point we should consider. Does the dash one amendments conform to the current relating clause?
Mr. Chair, I will have to call Legislative Council and get their interpretation. They are the ones that make the determination of what is applicable or allowable and what's not. So let me give them a call.
I will certainly do that. We will recess a work session on House Bill 3571 until we have that determination. Excellent point, Representative Ackerman. Thank you. And we will open a public hearing on... Actually, we're going to open, since we're in this mode of thinking, we're going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 3363 in terms of including wolves and wolf hybrids as the definition of a predatory animal, since we're dealing with predatory animal verbiage here. And as soon as Ray is finished, I understand we have some additional amendments which Ray has, and will talk to us briefly about those. So members will just stand at ease until Ray's off the phone.